Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, August 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan authorities abruptly replaced Deputy President Ruto's security details.
Having security is not a favor that you give to the Deputy President. It's a right, and it is Kenyans who actually put him there as the Deputy President.
We'll have analysis of this new development in the ongoing frosted relations between President Kenyatta and his deputy. We'll look at the impact of resurgent violence in rural Central African Republic. Two Nigerian TV reporters are questioned for what their interviewee said. And the WHO says vaccination rates in Africa are slowly improving.
For months, we've planned with national authorities to accelerate the vaccine rollout as soon as supplies became available. I'm delighted that in the past week, 13 million doses have been administered, triple that of the previous week.
It is confirmed that Uganda will temporarily host 2,000 Afghan evacuees and a partnership to protect Botswana's Okavango Delta. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan authorities on Thursday replaced the security at the residence of Deputy President William Ruto. The Elite General Service Unit, the GSU, was replaced by administration police officers. This development comes just 3 days after President Kenyatta asked his deputy to resign rather than criticize the government from within. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the Inspector General of Police says the decision is a normal reassignment of duties within the National Police Service intended to enhance efficiency and effectiveness.
Deputy President Ruto's Communication Secretary David Mugonyi on Thursday said in a statement that the Deputy President's office complained about what the statement termed as a diabolical demonstration of bad faith. Mugonyi said the Deputy President was not alerted on his change of security and was only briefed by the officer in charge of the GSU security at his residence that he had received instructions to withdraw all GSU officers by 2 p.m. yesterday, Thursday. This development, which comes just 3 days after President Kenyatta asked his deputy to resign, has sparked outrage from leaders loyal to the deputy president. Johnson Sakaja is the senator for Nairobi County.
Having security is not a favor that you give to the deputy president to give him security. It's a right, yeah? And it is Kenyans who actually put him there as the deputy president. So I think those overzealous people, and the IG actually also will have to answer to that, who are now trying to frustrate the deputy president by removing security, will know that it is counterproductive. It is working actually against their intentions.
Ruto's spokesman David Mugonyi further said in the statement that the deputy president had written to Inspector General of Police Hilary Mutambai seeking an official explanation to what he termed as a strange and unlawful act. Police spokesman Bruno Siosho said in a statement that the Inspector General of Police Hilary Mutambai defended the withdrawal of GSU officers from Deputy President Ruto's residence, saying it was a normal reassignment to enhance efficiency and effectiveness. However, these claims have been refuted by security experts. According to Police Standing Orders, Chapter 8, Section 5E, the GSU Commandant shall be responsible for security of the President, the Deputy President, state houses and state lodges throughout the country. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
In Kenya, the replacement of General Service Unit GSU officers guarding Deputy President William Ruto's official residence by the administration police officers is generating mixed reaction. Political analysts say this latest development could be the result of deteriorating relations between President Uhuru Kenyatta and the Deputy President William Ruto. George Msamali, a Kenya-based security analyst, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the replacement of the Deputy President's security detail appears to have politics written all over it.
I believe we have seen politics being played out here in terms of the Deputy President's security based on the fact that it's a constitutional office and the terms of securing the Deputy President's person and office is well spelled out in the Constitution. And what we are seeing is that this is illegal. This is something that we need to look out very keenly, because at the end of the day, we are exposing the Deputy President to risk that is well documented and well spelled out in the Constitution on how the Deputy President and the President are supposed to be protected. I think this is not right. This is very wrong.
So are you therefore saying that the Deputy President has a right to question this, despite the fact that traditionally it has been the police that provide protection to both the President and the Deputy President or Vice President?
Absolutely, because I served in the service where the unit I served was providing protection to the presidency and the deputy president. And clearly we have spelled out procedures and processes of how the president and the deputy are supposed to be protected. For example, we have what we call fixed site security. Fixed site security is under the preserve of a company in the general service unit that we call G Company. And the moment the president and the deputy president walk out of their residence, we have a unit we call the presidential escort unit that takes over from the G Company. And when he gets back to the residence, this is security that's taken over by the G Company of the GSU. So from my analysis, the message is that the deputy president is no longer considered a VIP, and the CIPU are there exclusively to take care of the infrastructure, that is the house and any other thing that belongs to the government.
The Deputy President office says the withdrawal with no explanation is strange and unlawful. Can he seek redress in court to address this concern of his?
Definitely can seek redress from the court, because his is a constitutional office and his protection is also constitutional. And we are shouting loudly that this is a question that has come up severally about the independence of the police in this country. And I've looked at it very closely and I said that when we had a new constitution in 2010, we said we need to have an independent police service. And in 2010, 2014, the same supporters of the deputy president went to parliament and changed the constitution such that the Inspector General of Police and his deputies are answerable to the president.
That was Kenyan political analyst George Msamali speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. The World Health Organization says vaccination rates in Africa are slowly gathering steam, but still has a long way to go to reach parity with the world's richest countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The third wave of COVID-19, driven largely by the highly contagious Delta variant, appears to have stabilized in Africa. But the World Health Organization says cases of the deadly disease remain high. The latest reports put the number of coronavirus cases at nearly 7.6 million, with almost 248,000 new cases confirmed over this past week. An estimated 191,000 people have lost their lives. While infections have plateaued in many areas, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, warns against complacency. Moeti says 24 countries are in resurgence and deaths are rising in 8 countries, including in Botswana and Ethiopia.
This is a preventable tragedy if African countries can get fair access to the vaccines. For months, we've planned with national authorities to accelerate the vaccine rollout as soon as supplies became available. I'm delighted that in the past week, 13 million doses have been administered, triple that of the previous week.
Moeti says new doses have been received from the COVAX facility, and governments, including the United States and some European countries, have shared excess doses with African countries.
We're still hopeful that 10% of people in Africa will be vaccinated by the end of September, a very daunting task. 117 million doses are due to arrive in the coming month, and up to 34 million additional doses will be needed to reach that target.
The World Health Organization is urging wealthy countries to share their surplus doses with African and other developing countries. It also is calling for a moratorium on booster shots until the end of September, so the poorer countries can increase their vaccine supplies. To date, only 1% of Africa's population of 1 billion has been inoculated against COVID-19. Moeti says those at highest risk of this disease can be protected with international solidarity and the equitable distribution of life-saving vaccines. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butter in Washington. Today is Friday, August 27. A resurgence of violence in rural areas of the Central African Republic is making it increasingly difficult for healthcare providers to reach isolated communities, according to Doctors Without Borders. The group's Central Africa head of operations, Sylvain Gros, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the deteriorating situation and the challenges it poses to the health needs of the residents.
Well, it's very, very complicated because obviously, first of all, you have first and foremost these groups that had control of the territory in the past and are now utilizing a bit of guerrilla warfare, hiding out in the bush, stopping people when they're traveling on the road to steal from them, entering upon villages to prey upon villagers. So it's a very, very difficult situation. And even the people that try to live out in the bush in rural areas, and especially when you have herders with cattle coming through the area, they're also taxed just like everyone else. And then now the control of some of these major towns or villages being under government control, we're still seeing the same pattern as in the past, whereby government forces are taxing levies on the roads, preventing people, a clear and free passage. So it's extremely, extremely complicated for people to have access to health services or just to be able to move freely.
There has been ongoing violence for a while now, unfortunately, in CAR. How has the situation changed or not in the past few months in as far as what MSF has seen?
What we're seeing is history repeating itself, unfortunately. Again, the population is stuck between a rock and a hard place, always prey by armed groups, whether they be government forces or whether they be opposition forces. During the last almost 20 years, the population has been suffering tremendously and have had very, very rare instances of peace. It has a complicated history, obviously, Central African Republic, but today, unfortunately, we're not seeing a situation where the lives are tremendously improved for the population, especially in the rural areas.
Given that kind of situation, how are groups like MSF trying to reach the populations and what challenges do you guys face?
Well, we have, MSF has strong roots in Central African Republic. We have a significant amount of projects throughout the country, which obviously supports in our emergency interventions throughout the different areas. We have emergency intervention teams. Our main obstacle is obviously whenever the situation changes, as it has over the last few months, it becomes very, very dynamic, very volatile, and very difficult for us to work in those contexts. We're able to, but sometimes with limitations of being able to reach out and going out into the periphery outside of the major towns and ensure the delivery of quality and free health services. And sometimes the context with all of the developments happening so quickly makes it very, very difficult for our teams. And again, more importantly, for the populations to have access to these health services.
That was Sylvain Gros, Central Africa head of operations for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Spain. Uganda has agreed to open its doors to 2,000 or more Afghan evacuees fleeing their country after the takeover of the Taliban. Halima Athumani spoke to Uganda's State Minister for Regional Affairs and has this report from Kampala.
John Mulimba, Uganda's State Minister for Regional Affairs, spoke to VOA a day after the first 51 Afghans arrived in the city of Entebbe on a chartered flight organized by development firm Sayara International. Mulimba said the U.S. government asked Uganda to temporarily host Afghans fleeing the Taliban.
Because a request from the United States dictated the numbers will be between 2,000 and maybe 2,500. So having received only 51, that's just a very minimal number. So many more are yet to come.
A spokesperson for the U.S. embassy confirmed Uganda has offered to host the Afghan evacuees and said the U.S. appreciates the Ugandan government's generosity. In the VOA interview, the regional affairs minister said some of the evacuees may be wanted by the Taliban.
All persons who were evacuated from Afghanistan have run away from the boundaries of their home country simply because of fear of persecution. They have now gone to other countries for safety. Now, where they are, they need to be given very deserving treatment in as far as recovery and settlement is concerned.
Mulimba added that photos and identities of the evacuees should not be published. To do so, he said, might endanger their lives. Uganda is known for accepting refugees and currently hosts more than 1.5 million refugees from other African countries. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Nigeria's National Broadcasting Commission, the NBA, yesterday Thursday, summoned two presenters of Channels Television for inciting divisive and unfair comments. The reporters had interviewed Benue State Governor Samuel Otom on Tuesday this week, during which the governor allegedly said that President Muhammadu Buhari's way of dealing with the insecurity in Nigeria was disappointing. According to local media, the governor also reportedly said that President Buhari's policy on the Fulani cattle herders was to make Nigeria a Fulani country. Channels Television officials were not immediately available for comment. Human rights activist Omoyele Sowore and other Nigerian broadcasters went to the National Broadcasting Commission's offices on Thursday to show their support for the Channels Television reporters. Sowore says they went to show their support for freedom of the press, the most important pillar of Nigerian democracy.
We approached the offices of the Nigerian Broadcasting Commission to uphold the tenets of democracy, particularly the most important stand upon which democratic rule in any nation stands, which is the freedom of the press. And when we arrived, we were told that all the money show presenters known as Sunrise Daily Show were in a conference room being interrogated, being grilled by officials of the NBC. And we stood guard at the gate with other activists until they left the venue, because we had heard in advance that there was a plan by the Nigerian secret police to pick them up after they had done there. So we ensured that they left without being harassed by the secret police known as the state security services.
According to one account in Nigerian newspapers, the NBC, meaning the National Broadcasting Commission, said it sanctioned Channels TV for inciting divisive and unfair comments made by Benue State Governor Samuel Otom. Do you know what the Benue State Governor might have said on Channels TV?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what the allegations against Channels were, because we didn't get to talk to the presenters when they left the venue. They were looking exhausted, having been grilled by state officials. But we know that they said it was due to an interview with the governor. And it's shocking because the governor has immunity and also has got a right to express himself freely as an elected official in Nigeria. So it is very bizarre that anybody will be held responsible for the views of a state governor. It shows the tyrannical nature of the regime. So I don't know beyond those particulars what other allegations are against them, but they know that there was also a situation where they interviewed one retired Navy commander who said that he knew people in the Buhari regime who were sponsors of Boko Haram, and the terrorist group that is destroying and killing people in the northeastern part of Nigeria.
Omoyele Sowore is a Nigerian human rights activist. You are speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Mining giant De Beers and the National Geographic Society have announced a partnership to protect the waters and endangered animals of Botswana's iconic Okavango Delta. The vast UNESCO World Heritage wetland is threatened by climate change and agricultural activities. Umkundise Dube reports from Habaroni.
The five-year project Okavango Eternal will see DPRs and National Geographic work with local communities to deliver ecological solutions aimed at preserving the 16,000 square kilometers of the delta. Bruce Clever, DPRs Group CEO, says in a statement the company is committed to preserving the delta for future generations. He says the project will help protect the delta's source waters and ensure the protection of wildlife corridors to ensure the free movement of animals. Clever says it is important to support livelihoods, particularly in the ecotourism sector, hard hit by COVID-19 travel restrictions. Kuogezo Mogodi, National Geographic Country Director for the project, says the protection of the delta is an urgent priority.
It is exciting to see this level of support and partnership at a time when coming together to protect this one-of-a-kind place is so urgently needed. The people of the Okavango Basin rely on its life-giving waters, and we must unite our efforts to do everything in our power to ensure that they continue to flow for the future of the people and the wildlife that calls this place home.
The Okavango Delta forms part of a large conservation area known as the Kavango Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area, KAZA, which covers five southern African countries. Nyambe, KAZA Executive Director, says the project presents an exciting opportunity for local communities and protecting the environment.
It is a welcome development, very welcome indeed. The threats that the Okavango Delta faces are real, range from the impacts of climate change, potential for agricultural development, large-scale water abstraction, infrastructure development, and related threats. All these threats cannot be addressed by one entity, so partnerships are very welcome.
The Delta is one of Botswana's prime tourist attractions, drawing an average of 50,000 visitors per year. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the Tokyo Paralympic Games. Nigeria became the first African country to feature on the Paralympic medal table after Latifat Tijani claimed powerlifting gold in one of the major highlights of day three events. The 39-year-old just missed out on the top podium spot in Rio 5 years ago, but this time around emerged as champion after lifting an impressive 107 kilograms in the women's 45 kilograms category. Staying with the Paralympic Games in Tokyo, the Games' youngest Paralympian, 14-year-old Ugandan swimmer Hosna Kukundakwe, competed on Thursday morning in the 100 meters breaststroke in the SBB category, achieving a personal best of 1 minute 34.35 seconds as the youngest Paralympian competing in Tokyo, announcing herself as a rising star of the future. Kukundakwe was born without her right forearm and has an impairment to her left hand. And also basketball news, the highly anticipated FIBA AfroBasket 2021 tournament got underway in Kigali on Tuesday. 16 national teams from across Africa are slugging it out for the right to be crowned the continent champions. Rwanda, host nation who edged the Democratic Republic of Congo 82-68 on Tuesday, came from a 6-point deficit against basketball powerhouse Angola to win the game by 71-68 to maintain a 100% record. And now to football news. The 2021 CAF Women's Champions League CECAFA regional qualifiers get underway this Saturday, the 28th of August. The qualifiers of the inaugural edition of the CAF Women's Champions League will take place in Nairobi, Kenya, with 8 teams from the CECAFA region taking part. Simba Queens from Tanzania, Lady Doors of Uganda, PVP FC of Burundi and FADFC of Djibouti are all in Group A, while Kenya's Vihiga Queens FC, Commercial Bank of Ethiopia, Ye Joint Stars of South Sudan and the New Generations Zanzibar are placed in Group B. Winnie Ayikoro, the Ye Joint Stars captain of South Sudan, says they are not just in Kenya to represent the club, but the country of South Sudan.
To put more effort to prepare the team ready for the competition. I'm confident. I'm ready to face any team that comes in front of me. Because we are not just here to represent the club only, but we came into the national level. We are here to represent South Sudan.
The champions of the tournament will represent the Sakafa region at the final tournament later this year in Cairo, Egypt. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, August 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, who is filling in for Nicole Beckford this whole week, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.